Welcome to Radio Survivor. We're here for the love of radio and sound. I'm Paul Riesmandel.
And I'm Jennifer Waits.
And today we're going to go back and visit border broadcasting, radio broadcasting along the border between Mexico and the United States. But today we're going to look at really more of the perspective from the Mexican side. We've talked in past about stations which were really directed towards English-speaking American audiences. And today we're going to look at and fill in more of that story. And what's fun here is this kind of interview I always love when it happens is our guest who's joining us read something that I wrote a few weeks ago about tuning in a station near Tijuana in Mexico late at night. So and I live in Portland, Oregon. And so which is fairly far away from Tijuana, Mexico, but on the frequency 1700 AM, which does not have a lot of stations on it, period, anywhere in North America or Central America, for that matter. And I heard pop music and, you know, American pop music, Huey Lewis. And then I heard what I believe to be Spanish, but couldn't quite make it out, you know, and again, my Spanish isn't great. Station ID breaks, I heard no commercials, it seemed weird, and I wrote about it. And our guest wrote in to sort of fill me in a little bit more and to alert us to the fact that that in fact she knows a lot about Mexican broadcasting, especially along the northern border. So I want to introduce Sonia Robles, who is an assistant professor of history at the University of Delaware and the author of the book Mexican Waves, Radio Broadcasting Along Mexico's Northern Border, 1930 to 1950. Welcome to Radio Survivor, Sonia.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, Sonia, on previous episodes, we've talked about some of these big, well-known border blasters like Wolfman Jack and, you know, the station that peddled these quack medical cures. And what I think is really interesting about your research is that you're looking beyond these kind of big stories of powerful broadcasters and looking more at the stories of maybe the lesser known and the lower power stations that were broadcasting along the northern border of Mexico. So I just wanted to start and ask why you think it's important to tell these particular stories.
Yes, excellent. I think that they complement each other in the creation of the borderlands. I think for so long, the conversation and the reports about the borderlands have been, you know, about crisis, about illegal behavior, about the things you mentioned, you know, these crazy, you know, 5,000-watt stations, these huge border blasters. Wolfman Jack, he always makes an appearance because how can you not just say Wolfman Jack?
Exactly.
You know, as somebody that was on the airwaves, right? But I think, you know, at the same time, it wasn't, you know, the Mexican government wasn't just granting, you know, these U.S. entrepreneurs or these, you know, U.S. Renegades, right, radio concessions. They were also granting them to Mexicans, right, to Mexican entrepreneurs. So they were doing it at exactly the same time, early 1930s, up until the period I study is right up into the Second World War. So I think it's important because they're happening at the same time, but for so long, these conversations about the border have really only focused on these sort of big stories, you know, the ways that they broke the law versus other people who were transmitting smaller stations, you know, 7.5 watt, you know, 200 watts, 100 watts, and they were just reaching their immediate regional audience on both sides of the border.
Yeah, I think that's what I love about broadcast historians, like bringing a lot of these stories to light that maybe weren't part of kind of this bigger history that you often hear about. So maybe we could take a little bit of a step back. You're focusing on 1930 to 1950. Can we talk a little bit about the beginnings of radio in Mexico and what was happening in the 1920s? And in particular, what was happening in Mexican broadcasting in the 1920s as far as what was being broadcast across the border too?
So Mexico, the Mexican Revolution is the beginning, you know, marks the sort of major event of the 20th century. It's the first social revolution. Many times, you know, I think the Russian Revolution gets a lot of credit for being the first, you know, but those of us who study Latin America, we like to, you know, remind people that it's, hey, you know, what about the Mexican Revolution, which began in 1910, you know, 1911. So Mexican Revolution really just creates chaos and devastation. You know, the countryside is a mess. There's been for Mexico, there was a large loss of population. You know, a lot of people have died. So by the 1920s, when radio begins, there's this desire to revamp the nation, to reconstruct the nation, to, you know, to really unify the nation. Mexico, the geography is actually quite mountainous, especially in the central area. In the north, there's, you know, deserts. And so I think the idea is to use broadcasting, or was to use broadcasting, to unite the population. And from the 1920s, at the same time, there were groups of immigrants who left Mexico because of the revolution and settled in the United States. And so since the 20s, you have some bilingual transmissions, a couple of special reports from the Mexican official stations, you know, to try to get the Mexican immigrants in the U.S. to hear the government, you know, the sort of, you know, yeah, hear the voice of the fatherland.
Uh-huh. I was curious about that. What can you tell us a little bit more about those official government stations?
Yeah, definitely. So for right now, I'm working a little bit more on other projects. One specifically is a station administered by the Ministry of Public Education. So I was fascinated by the interview the podcast that you had a couple of weeks ago, right, about educational radio, and I love that one. And so this official station begins in 1924. And they serve at this official station by the Ministry of Public Education. They have bulletins from pretty much all of the other ministries at the time. So we have public health. You know, there's this big anti-alcohol campaign, for example. There's also hygiene, and they're also doing these government. I mean, the president is going on there in the late 1920s, you know, early 1930s, and just, you know, speaking to whoever would listen. You know, but many times what they would do would be coordinate with consulates here in the United States. So consulates would hire out, you know, the local hall, right, and, you know, turn on the transmitter, you know, and just kind of invite a lot of people to hear. Yeah, I'm digging into this station. I have a series of records, you know, with me, thankfully, that I'm sorting through. But yeah, the official stations really begin at the same time as a commercial one. So 1923, 1924, but this particular station, this XFX is what it's called, the Ministry of Public Education station, really becomes the center of all of the of the majority of the official voice, right? This sort of official voice in the 20s up into the early 1930s.
And would you say it had sort of a propaganda type purpose, or more of? I'm just curious, like, what was the nature of the majority of what they were doing?
Yeah, excellent question. It was really a combination of education and propaganda and music. So I would say those three things, because in the afternoons they would have concerts. And so, for example, this past week, I ran into this, to what I found, you know, to be like this sort of peculiar story of this man who had traveled to Europe, this Mexican elite middle class man had traveled to Europe and returned to Mexico City with these records, with these, you know, classical music records, and he sent a letter to the station saying, you know, can I please go on there and play my records, you know, and the station was like, sure, we would love to, you know, we would love to have you, but then, you know, so they had sort of given him a schedule, okay, every Friday from, you know, 8 to 10 p.m., something like that, and then sure enough, you know, one of the Fridays when he's supposed to go to the station, you know, with, you know, hauling his records and play them, the president had, you know, would just happened that, you know, he wanted to also speak over the radio, you know, so I found this letter that, you know, was sort of just like, you know, dear Mr., you know, whatever, can you please push it back to tomorrow? You know, would you mind coming in tomorrow and, you know, and playing your records, because the president is going to be speaking. So yeah, you know, these peculiar kind of stories are, historians and scholars, you know, we live for that kind of, you know, like little mm-hmm. stories, but it's really the bigger story is just more that it wasn't just propaganda, right? It was music. And it was also instruction for housewives. The sort of founding member of the station was a woman. Her name was Maria Luisa Ross. And she was, yeah, I'm trying to dig into her as well. You know, she was, you know, the jefe de la oficina, right? You know, they never called her jefa; they always called her jefe. You know, and And she really wanted to focus on housewives, but also on children, children's education in the rural areas. So this is all really fascinating for me. But yeah, it's part of additional projects that I'm or current projects, I should say.
And I love hearing these stories about these women who were starting stations in the 1920s, because we don't often hear enough of those stories.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I think there's more there, and the history of Mexican radio, I think I mentioned this in the book, right? The focus so much has been on Mexico City, it's such a centralized, Mexico is such a centralized country. So, Mexico City kind of has always, led the narrative. But I think for so long, we know that there's other stories, right, happening in other places. So one of the reasons I got into, this topic of that I eventually, ended up writing my book about was because there were so many files at the National Archives from these stations along the northern border. And, it was almost about half, right? And I thought, well, this is strange, because for so long the story has been focused on Mexico City, the Mexico City stations. How is it that, in 1931, there was a station in Ciudad Juarez, but also, a bunch of stations in Mexico City, for example, and that's kind of how I got into it. But yes, I mean, there's so much to be written about the history of radio in Mexico still.
As Paul mentioned, you're on the show today in large part because of a response to Paul's piece where he talked about hearing a station from afar, and he wrote up kind of his reaction to that. And I know that you've looked at some of these listener responses in the United States to these early stations. So what were people hearing in the United States over the Mexican airwaves, and what was of interest to them?
So I would break it into two different groups. I would say that the English language listeners were hearing music, right? Much like Paul, they were, some of the letters I found, they were curious to understand, is this Spanish that I, that I'm listening to? I think it is, but I'm not sure. They wanted clarification, many of them. They were actually like literally writing letters to say, is this you, kind of letters. For the Mexican and for the Spanish language listeners that whose letters I've found in the archives, they were a little bit more critical of what they heard. Speaking of, women and, gender, right? The gendered soundscape, right? Which I know you've had Christine Eric on here before,
Yeah, for sure.
There's one particular letter that, is obviously just, compliments, and reaffirms her claims and her arguments. And it's a man, he was in New Orleans, right? So this Mexican, I'm assuming, middle class, sort of elite man, writing to Mexico City to, saying, I was so excited that I tuned in, last night, but I can't believe that you chose a woman to sing the national anthem. everything was great, but why did you choose a woman, to sing the national anthem? So the Mexican responses tend to be either just really critical in that way about, what they heard, because I think they see it as a representation of Mexico, right? And they were abroad, or it's the opposite. It's, thank you for making this happen. I feel closer to my home. Many of the immigrants, this has been a pretty long part of immigration. The immigration story is that there's always a hope to go back, mm-hmm. Right? There's always this idea that, yes, you're gonna do whatever it takes to make it to the United States, but you're either gonna be sending money back, or you're gonna be literally building a house, a second home back in Mexico, or back in Central America. With this illusion that you're going to return, and it doesn't happen, very often, but this sort of desire is still there, right? This kind of dream, and so it's all over the place, I guess, to answer that. The letters are definitely something that are fun, and that I feel really grateful for to have found in the archives, because I know that, and as you know as well, right? When we study media, we always get the question about reception, right? Well. Who was listening? what did they have to say? So I think I feel really grateful, but at the same time, it's this sort of burden of, I have to do something with this now, right? And I want to make sure that I'm telling the right story, The proper way.
Sonia Robles, talking about these Mexican radio stations that were directing some of their programming to, you know, the diaspora in the United States. I wonder if you know or have a sense for what the relationship was between the governments, Mexican and United States governments at the time, with, you know, specifically with regard to broadcasting. You know, this is sort of, when we're talking about, you know, the 1930s, it's still kind of early days for the for various types of covenants or treaties to be worked out to govern cross-border broadcasting. I don't know if, do you have any sense for whether this was, you know, officially sanctioned? Was this worked out between the two governments?
It doesn't really begin to be a problem for the U.S. government that these Mexican stations are broadcasting into the United States until these border blasters, right? Until, you know, Brinkley, Baker, these sort of outlaws, right, that went into Mexico and just, you know, did whatever they could to have these, you know, gigantic transmitters.
And roughly,
to
what's that time frame then? When does
so
that
this
happen?
This is 1931, 1932, 1933.
Okay.
So for the entire decade of the 30s, the U.S. is, I've also done a bunch of research at the Ministry of Foreign Relations in Mexico City. So that's really where you get these big State Department officials, you know, writing these memos, you know, can you please, you know, tell them to stop transmitting, you know, and then of course they become more aggressive, you know, and they say they've sort of violated X law from regional agreements. There are regional agreements in the 20s. But the biggest regional agreements come, you know, later in the 30s, like 1937. And then the Second World War kind of creates like a pause, right? And so then things get reorganized. And by the Second World War, the stations that I was focusing on, you know, from the 30s, they're no longer there. They don't come back. Like, you know, Brinkley doesn't come back after the Second World War. He's gone.
One of the border blasters, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, sorry. One of the border blasters doesn't come back. So the relationships between the governments were otherwise, you know, pretty standard. You know, this is the sort of pre-1940s, you know, relationships. I think Mexico is, like I said, Mexico's really starting to have this, you know, reconstruction policies and, you know, focusing on education, you know, focusing on reforming the countryside, you know, let's be more productive, you know, implementing technology. But as far as the airwaves are concerned, the U.S. government doesn't really pay attention until, you know, until these huge sort of border blasters.
Right. They care more about the border blasters, I mean, in part because they're broadcasting in English and in some cases broadcasting things that they could not broadcast to the United States. You know, that's a whole history unto itself, but there's a reason why they, you know, to some extent reached, you know, went to Mexico and left the United States. So that's interesting. And I think also as background, you know, we'll remind folks that, you know, certainly in the 1930s, we're still in the Great Depression in the United States. The administration for the most of the 30s is Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So that, you know, probably I could imagine again that these broadcasts to the diaspora from Mexico are not a high concern for an American administration at that time.
Sonia, I'm also thinking about, you write a bit about kind of the idea of the border, and maybe if you could talk about what is the border, the northern border of Mexico, how does that border feel during this period of time? And just as a personal example, my grandfather was working on ranches that were on both sides of the border in this period between 1923 and 1931. So in Calexico and Mexicali, and just like traversing back and forth, working, and in reading, you know, his memoir, you know, it seems very seamless. Like he's part of both of these communities. So what does that feel like at the time, both on the ground, but also on the airwaves?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, excellent. I'm not sure that you're familiar with this phrase. I know Chicano historians frequently use this phrase when they begin, you know, to talk about their history. But they say we didn't cross the border crossed us, right? And so, you know, as to sort of to set up, you know, the I think the answer to your yes, very excellent question. What did it actually look like? I think on the western side, you know, Tijuana, right? You know, we mentioned Tijuana earlier. Yeah, it was just this military outpost, late 20s, early 30s, right? You know, it's again, you know, prohibition plays a huge role, but other than that, you know, this isn't a very industrialized, you know, large, you know, the city doesn't have a huge population.
So could you drink legally in Mexico during prohibition?
Absolutely, yes.
Ah, okay, yeah. Yes. This explains yes. a lot.
Yes. Yeah. What one of the stations, XEBC, that I look at and that I feature in the book, was a station that was operated at the, Agua Caliente, casino and resort. It was, you know, horse racing, you know, you had, you know, the Hollywood elite going down there and they had a radio station, you know, that sort of, you know, that resort that transmit, you know, all kinds of things, right? A lot of them in English, of course, but you know, they didn't, you know, they weren't a high power station at all. I think it's like 50 or 100 watts or so. So it looked really different on the western side. On the you know, if we look at the northern border, as you know, sort of starting over here in, you know, Tijuana and then Ciudad Juarez, right? El Paso is kind of like right in this middle area, you know, we have the river, right? You know, which begins in this sort of, you know, river valley over towards Texas. Over there on the eastern and the sort of, you know, central side, there are older cities, you know, so we have, you know, Spanish, you know, colonial era, you know, type of cities because, you know, obviously, you know, before the United States became the United States and Mexico became Mexico, right? You know, Spain had control there and Spain had set up, again, you know, little military outposts. So there are more people right on that side of the northern borderlands in the early 1930s and in the 20s, but they don't see, you know, an actual barrier, right? You know, between the two countries. I think it's, you know, one of the women actually that I mentioned in the book, you know, she wrote to, you know, to the Ministry of Public, of Communications and Public Works, you know, please let me have a regional station. You know, I want to cover, you know, the entire, you know, river valley, right? Because she, in her mind, you know, that's, you know, this is what the airwaves can do. So, you know, why shouldn't I be able to, you know, to have this kind of business, right? So I think that, yeah, you know, this maybe goes back a little bit to the motive of, you know, for writing this book and telling this story. I think, I really, when I was doing this research, I really saw that these Mexican entrepreneurs, that they acknowledged that the border, you know, could be a very, you know, restrictive and sort of a limiting place, or that it didn't really exist for them, right? That what they were into, you know, the business that they did, that they crossed the border. So it's fine, you know, let's just use this station to, you know, to get businesses, you know, from the U.S. side to sponsor us. And let's just try to keep the lights on. So that was why I focused on, or I, you know, my intention was really to focus on them as entrepreneur, Mexican entrepreneurs.
Yeah, you know, you think about the border of U.S. and Mexico today, like that whole idea is so fraught in our culture because of the divisiveness that's happening in the United States right now with immigration but thinking about this period of time and thinking about radio at the border, that idea of border can be so, it feels so different in 2020. And I think about the border radio that you're talking about, all these different layers of listeners. You have listeners in the United States and in Mexico. And I'm assuming that, you mentioned that broadcasts could be bilingual, so you have different languages. Can you maybe just explain more of what's going on and who the assumed audience is? Is the audience assumed to be on both sides of the border and speaking both languages? I'm sure it's different from station to station, but maybe talk about a few examples.
Definitely. There's one Mexican entrepreneur that I look at. His name is Jorge Rivera, and he had the concession to operate a station in Tijuana, XEAC, right? XEAC, and he explicitly when he was being when they were when the when the sort when the government when the government was trying to impose its laws and, you know, try to give him, you know, to restrict him from what he was broadcasting, he wrote back and complained and said, I broadcast, you know, Mexican music and Spanish language music at night and early in the morning because my audience is in the United States and they're working during the day. And during the day, I broadcast English language programming because that's when, you know, my audience in the United States is at home, you know, so housewives or, you know, people working. So
interesting.
You know, there are other examples of broadcasters, operators who said, you know, we want to do dedications, for example. You know, Mexican law said that you couldn't, you know, say somebody's full legal name over the airwaves, right? You know, all these, you know, particular things. And, you know, when they were writing back in their complaints to the Mexican government, they said, well, this is the way they do it in the United States. And, you know, the people in the United States, you know, are, this is the audience that we intend to please. And so, you know, we're going to keep doing this. You know, there is a lot of defiance, you know, for the law. Not so much, I think, for the border, right? I think that this is another thing that I was really trying, you know, hoping to uncover. It's not that these Mexican entrepreneurs or, you know, the people that I feature, it's not that they defied the border. It's just that they acknowledged that the legal border was there, right? But they just, you know, they had, you know, I think I said this right before, you know, a couple minutes ago, they had businesses that could defy the border, you know, that could just cross. And so, their sort of beef was more with the Mexican government, right? And the way that the Mexican government was trying to restrict them. So there's bilingual commercials as well that towards the end of the book, and this is also, you know, some other projects that I'm working on advertising. The Mexican law changes during the Second World War, because they actually allow Mexican radio stations to receive advertising money from businesses in the United States.
Oh yeah, I was wondering about that. Like, who? Because you're talking about commercial stations. So yeah, who is paying for the commercials?
Exactly. So you know, we would have a panaderia, right? You know, a tortilleria that was in El Paso, and that wanted to, you know, to sell their bread, right, or their furniture, right? You know, to their local audience, but they had to go, you know, across the border to Ciudad Juarez to pay that station to advertise for them to broadcast, you know, back into Texas.
Oh, so they could do that. They could cross the border to pay the bill.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they would cross they would cross the border, you know, pay the bill. And it worked really well for them, especially, you know, right, you know, early 1940s. Until after the Second World War, that's when you had when you begin to see more of the Spanish language, like full time, you know, 24 hours a day stations. Before that, you know, these you know, Mexican immigrants in the United States, they had limited outlets, right? You know, limited ways that they could actually sell their products. And so, so as I said, this is also a new project that I'm working on, because there are a lot of, you know, furniture stores. There's a lot of, you know, obviously, markets, you know, the little bodegas, you know, there's a lot of, you know, car repairs, you know, garages, and, you know, you have taxi services, for example, you know, that are using, you know, in the United States, that are using these Mexican stations to broadcast their services in Spanish, you know, for the audience, you know, in San Antonio, for example, you know, way up north. Mm-hmm.
And so I'm assuming, just maybe give us a little bit of context about what's happening on the United States licensed airwaves, as far as having programming that's aimed at a Spanish speaking population or immigrants? Like, how much of that is happening in that period of time, 1930 to 1950?
Yeah, definitely. There's one broadcaster that whose story I tell. His name is was Pedro J. Gonzalez. He was a operator in Los Angeles, and he had a radio program called Los Madrugadores, which is the, you know, the early risers, because it was, his program was from 4 to 6 in the morning, you know, during the weekdays. And he wanted to, you know, the purpose was, you know, so this is over a U.S. commercial radio station, just to clarify. And he wanted to, yeah, to basically, you know, wake people up, you know, as they were getting ready to go to work. And so I heard about him. I don't remember how, but his papers are at UCLA at the Chicano Studies Research Center. And so, you know, at that archive, you know, there are a couple, you know, letters from listeners from the time, you know, so early, you know, earlier, you know, mid 1930s that are saying, you know, thank you so much. You know, you really help, you know, every time, you know, I heard you on the radio, I knew it was time to wake up, you know, and, you know, as my wife, you know, made breakfast for me, you know, I listened to you, you know, these type of, you know, still really traditional, right, you know, types of stories. But he was really famous. He recorded, you know, with, now I'm not gonna remember the exact name, but, you know, he, you know, also was a singer and a performer. And so he is one example. So what they would call them would be block programming, right? So Mexican entrepreneurs and, you know, Mexican businessmen, a lot of these, you know, this happened obviously also, you know, in Texas, right? You know, Texas and California are these big, big central areas. And so they would pay for the advertising and pay for the airtime for this, you know, these particular blocks of time. And the, you know, the U.S. commercial stations, of course, would say, you know, sure, if you can pay for it, you know, go ahead, right? But they would, you know, they would be limited to only playing, you know, Spanish language music or Spanish language programming during that time, you know, whatever they could pay for. And usually it was early in the morning, you know, sometimes late at night. I have found, for example, you know, sort of, you know, related, I have found other like religious programming, you know, like sometimes they would broadcast like mass, for example, in Spanish, which I don't know who paid for that, you know, but, you know, I'm assuming, you know, it was a combination of, you know, maybe, you know, a Catholic church, you know, in LA, but I am, you know, that is you know, I was curious about that when I saw a lot of,
yeah, we've heard that we've had a number of episodes that have talked about religion on the radio, and we've heard bits and pieces of that story. As far as, you know, religious broadcasters paying for airtime on different stations, you know, people who didn't necessarily have their own station. So that kind of rings true. And that's interesting that there's also the Spanish language component to religious broadcasting at that time.
Well, it continues to today, right? I mean,
definitely.
You know, paid time programming, especially on the AM dial, is still very common in the U.S. And I want to remind everyone, we're listening to Radio Survivor. Well, we're making Radio Survivor. You're listening to Radio Survivor. And we're here for the love of radio and sound. My name is Paul Reese-Winnell. With me is Jennifer Waite. Our guest today is Sonia Robles, who is the author of Mexican Waves, Radio Broadcasting Along Mexico's Northern Border, 1930 to 1950. It's out from the University of Arizona Press. Sonia is also an assistant professor of history at the University of Delaware. And we are, you know, specifically talking about this range of broadcasting along the U.S.-Mexican border during this period, sort of pre and post-war, post-World War II.
And we've been talking about the immigrant story and how immigrants had access to the airwaves. And on the show, we've talked about this as well, and how certain populations have been historically excluded from the airwaves in the United States. And you write in your book a bit about how, I think I want to quote from you because it's such a great quote. You say, like Mexican immigrants, the African-American community purchased many phonographs and records during the 1920s and 1930s and turned away from local English language radio because it did not reflect their taste, preferences, and culture. So I wanted to see if you could talk a bit about that dynamic and the role that Mexican immigrants played in early U.S. radio.
Yes. As the quote that you just mentioned says, I think, you know, records are a real key actor, right, in this radio story, not just for the borderlands, but I think for Mexican radio in general, because the Mexican recording industry just had a late start compared to the United States. I think, you know, the broadcasting industry was, you know, pretty much, you know, right there. We have, you know, 1921, right? You know, the first, you know, stations. But I think the recording industry takes a little bit longer to take off. And so what's happening is that the Mexican, you know, stars are traveling to the northern borderlands first, and then, you know, going to, you know, for example, San Antonio, and then, you know, over towards LA, or but you know, mostly actually, you know, New York, for example, to make records in Spanish, right? These Spanish language records. Some of them are staying in the United States. Tito Guizard is one of them, for example, you know, hired by NBC. You know, he begins, you know, this, I think the program was called something, The Americas, you know, El Programa de las Americas or something. And so, you know, Mexican stars really make a name for themselves in the United States first with these records. And then they go back to Mexico, right? That they, a lot of them don't stay here in the, you know, in the United States. They go back to Mexico. Because they want to, you know, obviously, you know, they that's where they began, or, you know, they have a radio contract, you know, a film contract, you know, something like that. And so records are really important. And a lot of this story is told by several authors, but one singer that has to be mentioned, who I mentioned a couple times in the book, is Lidia Mendoza. She was the really famous, you know, she was a Chicana, right? She was born in Texas, but she recorded, I don't even run it, you know, I don't even remember, you know, the amount of records that she made, but she was called the Alondra de la Frontera, you know, the sort of, you know, songbird of the border. And she was really famous and traveled, you know, in these circuits. I know that, you know, several, like I said, you know, Chicana scholars have written about her. There's also an autobiography, you know, about her, a couple of other pictures. And so yes, you begin to see that that records are sort of, you know, they kind of lead a lot of the story of the radio for the Spanish language community. They would just prefer, you know, to buy the record than to turn on the radio, you know, in the United States, because it wasn't in their native language. It wasn't, you know, what they wanted to hear. So,
And these records, they weren't hearing on the radio in the U.S. So, I mean, is that part of the reason, you know, a lot of these border stations, were they playing a lot of music?
Yes, absolutely. So one of the chapters, I begin with a story of this group that, you know, goes into Mexico to, you know, play a song live on the air. And then they go back into, you know, to San Antonio to record the song, right? because, you know, just to kind of show you, right, all in, you know, within a couple of hours, right, you know, because basically, yeah, I mean, you know, many times it, or Lidia Mendoza, right, who I just mentioned, you know, many times that they would play her records, you know, because she was a little bit more popular, but it was expensive to pay for records, right, for a lot of these stations as well. So, you know, it was expensive to hire artists, but it was also expensive to get the record. So, you know, many times it was just sort of, you know, let's see who can, you know, who can show up for this, you know, this live broadcast, or, you know, let's play sort of older records. But as far as in the United States, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Mexican stars, they would go to the United States, you know, they would make records, but then they would go back. And so some of the records obviously stayed here, and the Mexican immigrant community purchased them, right? And so that was what they were playing at home.
So just shifting a little bit, you also talk a little bit about the difference between broadcasting and the northern border versus in other parts of Mexico. So I'm curious about, you talk about there are specific advantages that these broadcasters have on the northern border. So what are those? Why do they have a leg up broadcasting in that area?
For parts, for their transmitters, for their stations, you know, obviously I think, you know, right before, or we began this interview talking about all the cables, right, in Paul's, you know, Paul's desk, right, you know, all this equipment, you know, that you have, you know, for recording. So a lot of the, especially, you know, Tijuana, Ensenada, you know, I found, you know, a lot of these records of these operators, you know, going to LA, for example, you know, to buy the parts that they needed, you know, for their station in Tijuana. obviously, you know, they could do that within a week, a couple of weeks. You know, if you're in central Mexico and you're trying to get, you know, a tube, you know, or you know, some sort of an old, you know, microphone, it's going to take you months, right? You know, in the 1930s. Later with the Second World War, the U.S., you know, just, I don't have the specifics here, right? You know, but they stopped production, right, on a lot of this material. And so a lot of the stations in Mexico, they actually couldn't, you know, get off, the, you know, begin because they needed a particular part that they could only purchase in the United States, right? So I think, you know, being closer to San Antonio, being closer to Los Angeles, you know, really helps with the actual parts of stations. And then on a couple occasions, there were some operators that went to these, you know, wild, you know, I have no idea what type of schooling this was, but, you know, they sort of operator, you know, broadcasting school of the 1920s, you know, and in LA, you know, and they would go. And again, I don't know what kind of curriculum, you know, they had in this type of operator, you know, broadcaster school, but they would get their training in the United States and then they would go back to Mexico. And be, you know, have, be more professional, you know, sort of have the certificate that said, you know, I went to school in X broadcasting place in, you know, Los Angeles or Hollywood, something like that. So,
two examples. That proximity to, the technology that you could purchase in the United States. And then you mentioned the proximity to recording studios. That's very interesting, kind of traversing, you know, across the border, for these very pragmatic reasons.
How industrialized is Mexico at this period? And so let's talk about sort of maybe the pre-war period, you know, in the 1930s, right? Because certainly at this point, the United States is very industrialized and moving into more of a, you know, technologically industrialized, which of course is propelled all the more forward by World War II. And our need to, you know, to develop military equipment. So I'm wondering, you know, and so you mentioning how the broadcasters who are along the border, you know, have access to go buy equipment in the United States, in part because that's really where it's manufactured at this point in time. Mm-hmm. It's not, yes, you know, unlike now where we associate, you know, electronics and such equipment coming from China or East Asia, you know. Well until the 1970s, you know, these things were principally manufactured in the United States or Europe. So, you know, was there even that domestic capacity in Mexico at the time in the 1930s?
Yes, not really. It was a lot of just homemade, right? You know, types of receivers. I mean, I think the industrialized history, I mean, the history of industrialization in Mexico is limited to the north. You have, you know, Monterrey, for example, you know, the second largest city in Mexico, you know, the center, in the 19th century and, you know, before the revolution, there was a lot of focus on textiles, for example, you know, this is remnants from the colonial era, right? You know, Spain, you know, needed, you know, different little, you know, outposts and things like that. So it's in the north, it's in the center. You know, one of the problems that Mexico has is there isn't a lot of arable land, right? And so there are obviously, you know, farms and, you know, there is, you know, wheat production, you know, during the colonial era, you know, for the first time, obviously a lot of, you know, corn and a lot of, you know, fruits, vegetables, et cetera, et cetera. But I think, you know, compared to the population, there just isn't a lot of focus in using up this arable land. And so that kind of, you know, can't really happen. It's not until the Second World War that Mexico begins, you know, more industrialization, automobile plants, you know, a lot of, you know, providing raw materials, right, you know, for the Allies. Mexican government takes a while to align with, you know, with the Allies, but once they do, you know, they provide some raw materials. This really helps Mexico, the Mexican economy, you know, sort of take off. There's a post-World War II boom. The historians have called it the Mexican miracle, for example, you know, this sort of, so I think, yes, excellent question. It just doesn't have, yeah, the industrial capabilities for these little trinkets, right? You know, what some people might call them, you know, this little, you know, the one cable or, you know, this one particular tube or, you know, the quartz, you know, that was etched.
Kind of to get back to these border stations, could you maybe share, I love to hear quirky stories, maybe some quirky stories about some of the more unusual stations that were operating on the northern border of Mexico?
Yes. I think quirky can be widely defined, right? I think there were stations in Tijuana and Ensenada that were a little bit, you know, on the sort of, I don't know what like a good definition for it would be, that they were on lawbreakers, but not really lawbreakers, right? You know, that there's a way that you can, you know, break the law in Mexico and, you know, get away with it, and, or, you know, not get away with it. And so, you know, one particular station that comes to mind is this man by the name of Jorge Labastida. Sorry, it took me a little bit. Who had the station in one of the islands off of Ensenada. And he, you know, basically, I don't know, like one weekend, you know, I don't know, pretended that somebody was stranded, you know, and on this island, and got the attention of, you know, of San Diego, got the attention of, you know, the sort of the U.S. side, and, you know, kind of played a hoax on them, you know, and the archive, it appears, and there's, you know, there's like 20 newspaper articles, you know, of just like, you know, Mexicans play cruel joke on, you know, on us, you know, like that they got on the airwaves and sort of, you know, pretended like somebody was drowning, you know, things like that. So again, it's not really quirky. It's just more kind of, you know, playing a joke on the United States government a little bit. I mean, one of the stories that I really like is they have to do a little bit more with ways people use the station. So, you know, one particular woman, for example, in 1938, you know, she goes to the station. She's just found out that her husband has died, and she's trying to send a radio message to her town. You know, she's trying to let people know that she's on her way, basically. And you know, she goes to the station, and they say, well, you know, you can't. You have to have this, you know, particular authorization from, you know, from the government worker that, you know, that's in charge, the government broker in charge of the station. And she writes back kind of saying, you know, what are you talking about? You know, you guys are obvious, you know, you're constantly advertising, you know, commercials for beer, you know, you're advertising, you know, baptism, you know, when somebody's having a party, you know, she gives this long list of things, you know, like, why can't I basically, you know, tell my family, you know, that I'm on my way, kind of thing. And so it's more, you know, I found in the archives more examples of that, right, of ways that people were using stations in a particular way. And so, yes, I think that does reflect, obviously, on the programming, but also on just, you know, what radio means, you know, to people in northern Mexico, right? You know, how do they use it to obtain a particular, you know, a pretty simple purpose, you know, like talking to my family quickly.
Right. Right? Uh-huh. Well, so which, in the United States, you're not supposed to do that because it's considered point-to-point communication. Like, right. You're not supposed to talk directly to one person. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that was part of their issue or...
Can we dig into
or
that?
Or if it really was just hypocrisy.
You know, dig into the meaning, right? Like, so I think that's often, you know, that changes over time, and of course has changed over time. Anywhere there's radio, what radio means to somebody in 1930 is certainly different than it means now 90 years later. Can you talk a little bit about, like, what radio means to or meant to those listeners, whether they were on either side of the border, but listening to these stations?
Yes. I mean, I think for Mexican immigrants in the United States, these Mexican stations, you know, along the northern border were connections to home, right? It was a connection to a place that they had, you know, that they had to flee, you know, during the revolution, for example, you know, sometimes, you know, forcefully, right, you know, to, you know, literally, because it was, you know, better to, you know, to be on the run, right, you know, than to stay, you know, in a particular village. So it's a connection to home. There's a lot of nostalgia with this music, you know, this sort of, you know, I know that in the letter that I, when I responded to the initial, you know, DXing at, you know, or at, you know, 1700, or I forget now the name of the particular post that you mentioned, you know, I think, you know, music is so powerful, right? And I'm not sure how many people in the United States, I think, you know, when you listen to just a lot of this music that is played here in the United States, or music that you might hear at a Mexican restaurant, for example. You know, it's, you know, this is country music, right? You know, this isn't, you know, these aren't the urban sounds of, you know, Mexico City, for example. And the reason that, you know, that this particular music is chosen is because so much of the immigrant population is from the rural countryside, right? You know, historically, they have been from these rural areas. And so you're playing this country music that is talking about, you know, how much I love my ranch and how wonderful it is to, you know, go outside, right? And, you know, be with my family, or, you know, or the changing of the seasons, or, you know, things like that, you know, things that really sort of display how beautiful, you know, the Mexican countryside is. This isn't, you know, this urban sound, right, that people in Mexico City are playing or are even interested in, right? So there's a big disconnect. This has come up in a lot of my classes, right? You know, when I teach about Mexican history, and they, you know, people in Mexico, they don't understand how the U.S. audience, you know, can't understand that the people who are undocumented aren't from the cities, right? You know, that they're from the countries, you know, that there's this disconnect, you know, or they think, oh, all of you guys think we're all, you know, undocumented, or there's a big disconnect between rural and urban. So I think for the Mexican immigrants in the United States, you know, the radio was really a connection. It was a portal, you know, to their home, a way to connect easily, right? And as far as the local population in Mexico, I mean, I think the example that I gave, you know, of this widow would be one example. I think it was a tool. It was technology in the 30s. It was exciting, right? You know, just to be able to, you know, to have, you know, to see these big towers, right? You know, the archives, you have these pictures of stations, you know, because you had to turn in a diagram of what your tower was going to look like, you know, mm-hmm. when you requested a concession, you had to have an engineer draw, you know, outline this, you know, draft this, you know, this tower. And so, you know, this was a big deal, you know, especially in, if you think of what the northern border, you know, the desert, you know, you're driving along, you know, and you see, you know, this gigantic tower, right? So I think that it was symbolic. It was progress. It was technology, right? It was modernity, things like that.
You also talk a bit about some of these stations that pretended they were in the United States when they were actually in Mexico. What was that all about?
Yes. I think I opened the introduction, right, with the story, and you know, the testimony from the operator was, you know, I didn't think people would, my friends would believe me, you know, you know, that I was really in Mexico, right? So I pretended to be in Los Angeles, which, you know, you would think it'd be the other way around, right? But I think yes.
And why do you think his friends wouldn't believe him? Is it part of this sort of you know, we're talking about there being more production and industry in the United States. Is that why?
Yeah, the sort of industrial, you know, superiority, you know, technological superiority, right? The sense of, you know, are you really listening in your garage? You know, I mean, you know, that this goes back to the sort of, you know, the ham, right? And the DX, you know, culture of, you know, you have these shacks, right? This radio shacks. And so, you know, yeah, it was sort of just like, well, my friends aren't going to believe that I'm really, you know, building this, you know, this transmitter here, you know, but they would believe me if they thought I was in, you know, in the United States, because they're, you know, more industrialized, you know, they have the technological capabilities, right? Things like that. So, yeah, I mean, that it was the Border Blasters that actually really, really tried to have their station on the U.S. side, and, you know, turned in these crazy proposals to, you know, buy the cables that would connect, you know, El Paso with Ciudad Juarez. And, you know, they had a lot of money, so they had resources, so they wanted to do that. But the Mexican government repeatedly, you know, just said, this is a Mexican, you know, your concession is in Mexico, and you better stay on this side of you know, the border. It was just more, it was pretending, I think, you know, to be in the U.S. that happened several times. I'm sure it's happened more than the times that I found, but it is curious. It's interesting, yeah.
Sonia Robles, you're author of the book Mexican Waves, Radio Broadcasting Along Mexico's Northern Border. You're assistant professor of history at the University of Delaware. And I actually want to ask you, what got you interested in this topic? What brought you your interest to trying to learn more about this broadcasting along Mexico's northern border?
Yeah, I grew up traveling back and forth between the United States and Mexico. My mother's from Texas. My father's from Mexico City. When I was growing up in Mexico City, I went to elementary school there. My parents had a U.S. van, you know, like a Scooby-Doo kind of van, you know, and we would, but it had the U.S. plates. And so we would leave, you know, we would make these border runs, you know, these trips. And so, so for me, the border was always, yes, it was a place, could easily be crossed. Right. But they didn't have a lot of, you know, particular meaning, right? It was a little bit of this, it's a little bit of that, right? It's looking for its own kind of meaning. So that's sort of just the personal side, you know, the background. But as an academic, right, and as a graduate student, I think it wasn't that I began as a radio scholar or somebody that was interested in this. It was that I was looking for a topic that was, you know, that talked about media and that was also transnational. You know, a topic that defied borders, you know, kind of, you know, broadly speaking. And so I was, you know, I was interested in film, you know, I was interested in, you know, magazine, you know, just, you know, any type of, you know, media that's just sort of, you know, circulating. And so during the year of research in Mexico City, you know, just kind of sitting around in the archives, you know, I was when I found all of these files from these stations. Right. I mean, I think it's really important. I feel that for people to understand that it's not that, like, I think many times historians, we focus on, you know, like this particular little kernel. Right. And, you know, we're like, you know, this happened in this corner and this time period, you know, and maybe there's the impression that this is how it all began. Right. But it many times it's the other way around. Right. It's sort of, you know, hey, I was looking into this bigger project, but the sources really kind of led me to the story, right? Because we can't really tell a story without the sources as historians, right? You know, as novelists, of course you can, right? As, you know, when you're writing fiction, this is great, right? Because you can say all these wonderful things, you know. But I think for us, you know, we're tied so much to our sources and, you know, the story, the incomplete story, right? Of course it's incomplete, right? But the incomplete story that they're telling. So that's how I got into it. And then, like I said, I think my graduate advisor really challenged me to, you know, to push the boundary and to use these archives on both sides of the border. You know, he said, you know, you're bilingual, you know, you've grown up in, you know, both of these places, you know, just go for it, you know, kind of thing. And so I think, I really dug into archives in both places, but I focused on the Mexican story, right? The Mexican side of the story.
Yeah, because that really fills in a lot of gaps, right? Is a lot of the scholarship about border radio really takes a different approach, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, definitely. And I've met both Gene Fowler and Bill Crawford, you know, who wrote Border Radio, and, you know, and I think they're wonderful people. You know, I think that their story is fascinating. You know, and I know other people have also written about, you know, these border blasters, but their book is sort of, you know, the classic, you know, the classic tale. But I think, you know, they were enthusiastic also to know more about the Mexican side of the story, because in their research, they, you know, they came across that as well, right? And so it's not a mystery to those of us kind of on the inside, right? It's more just how can we make our story, you know, known outwardly, right? You know, what can we tell the public? It wasn't just the border blasters, it was also, you know, these Mexican entrepreneurs who were doing their own thing during this very particular, you know, time in history of radio.
Yeah, Sonia Robles, I love that you've really helped to expand our understanding of border radio. That's something that I love doing on Radio Survivor, is kind of broadening our perspective about what was happening in any given era and telling some of these untold stories. So thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Sonia Robles is a teacher and a scholar of Mexican and U.S. broadcast media history and author of Mexican Waves, Radio Broadcasting Along Mexico's Northern Border, 1930 to 1950. You can hear a slightly longer version of this interview online at radiosurvivor.com, where this podcast is available. On behalf of Paul Reismandel and Jennifer Waits, my name is Eric Klein. Thank you so much for listening.